Hi, Guns Unpacked listeners. We do our best to make sure that episodes are timely and accurate, but these days, the world, including the world of firearms, is changing at a chaotic and fast-paced speed. Our commitment to building a better gun debate is not subject to change, but specific events, policies, and trends may have shifted by the time you listen to this podcast episode. Thank you for tuning in to in-depth conversations about guns that transcend the typical gun divides.
This is Guns Unpacked, a podcast where we interrogate, engage, and elevate the terms of the gun debate as we know it. I'm your host, Alex Young, Associate Director of the Bridges Initiative at Arizona State University, where we aim to bring research and innovation into the debate on guns and society. I'm excited to join my colleague, Jenny Carlson, as a co-host on Guns Unpacked this season, and I'm especially excited to welcome my two guests today, Cameron McWhirter and Zusha Ellenson. Cameron is a national reporter for the Wall Street Journal based in Atlanta. He's covered mass shootings, violent protests, and natural disasters across the South. He's also the author of Red Summer, The Summer of 1919 and the Awakening of Black America. Previously, he's reported for other publications in the U.S., as well as in Bosnia, Iraq, and Ethiopia. Zusha is a reporter for the Wall Street Journal also, where he covers America's gun culture and gun industry. He is based in Northern California. Their book, American Gun, The True History of the AR-15, was just released in paperback this September. It has received multiple accolades since its initial publication in 2023, including being named a finalist for the Los Angeles Times Book Prize, being included on the Washington Post's list of top 50 nonfiction books of 2023, and being named Best Nonfiction Book of 2023 by Kirkus Reviews. So Zusha and Cameron, kind of building on your work as reporters that I just covered in my intro and thinking about the fact that you've worked on all kinds of different beats in very different parts of the country, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about how the idea to write this book on the AR-15 arose and how you decided to write it together.
Zusha and I were covering mass shootings. He's based in the San Francisco area. I'm based in Atlanta. We're paired up on a story that was initially a business story looking at how the AR-15 came to be so popular. We found this amazing, wild history of this rifle and how it became the gun that everyone's yelling about. That is really sort of the origins of how the book came to be. We found ourselves texting each other every time there was a mass shooting, like, was it an AR-15? And the answer repeatedly was yes.
Speaking of that fascinating history, I came to this knowing something about Eugene Stoner, knowing something about the history of the weapon, but I learned a ton, especially in that first part of the book. I wonder if the experience was the same for both of you, that I found myself, you know, almost rooting for Armalite as this like plucky little startup and Stoner as this quirky inventor, kind of going head to head with the military industrial complex, with all the corruption and inefficiencies of the federal government's arms procurement process. Was that experience similar for you as you were going through it?
This is one of the most surprising and fascinating parts of the story of the AR-15. The inventor, Eugene Stoner, he's this very soft-spoken guy who loves to wear bow ties. He never swore. When he was upset, he would say, "Boy, that frosts me." He refused to spank his children, but all he thought about all day, every day was gun designs. He was obsessed with them. He would be scribbling designs while they're out to dinner on the tablecloths. His wife would scold him, "They stop writing on the tablecloths." And he would say, "Oh, they can wash it out. It's okay." But yes, the character at the very origin of this gun that's at the fulcrum of our debate is just incredible. He's this mad, absent-minded professor, not a tough alpha male you might expect or something like that. And on top of that, he never went to college to learn about gun design. He never studied under anyone who designed guns. He came up with all these ideas by himself in his garage, sort of thinking outside the box because he wasn't confined by the sort of dogmas of the industry, of education, and all that sort of thing.
Another sort of related thing that fascinated me that I did not know about is, you know, the extent to which this almost mythic story of Stoner's invention has come to be used to market the AR-15. And thinking about that got me thinking about something else that I think has been central to a lot of these debates. I'd be interested in your take on it. I mean, do you think the AR-15 really is that technologically exceptional a weapon? Or is there something about this story that is kind of added to this mythology that is constructed the AR-15 as a symbol for some of these broader issues that have, you know, accelerated the pace of these mass shootings?
I think you can look at the mythology as one aspect. The politics and how this gun became a political icon for people to debate over is one story. But Eugene Stoner was a pretty amazing inventor. And it also, he arrived at a time when there were new materials that could be used. He'd worked in the aircraft industry in Southern California where, you know, aluminum, fiberglass, these things were starting to be used to create airplanes. He was one of a handful of people who started to say, well, wait a minute, we need to look at these materials being used for rifles to make rifles lighter. The way he developed the rifle, how gas was used, the gas expelled from each round was used, and the materials to sort of develop how that gas would be guided in the rifle made it lighter. He created a pretty amazing invention. So it is extraordinary. I mean, it is still, that platform is still in use by the U.S. military.
But just to jump in on your question about the symbolism, I think the symbolism of the gun really grows as we watch its journey through the American culture, right? I mean, it starts off as this very niche product. For your listeners, the military adopts this gun. It's a fully automatic or select fire gun. And then Colt, which is manufacturing it at this point, decides to sell a civilian version, semi-automatic. They market it as this superb hunting partner in the 1960s. No one buys it. Absolutely no one. They're making a couple thousand a year. Hunters don't like it. They're not used to it. They don't like this chintzy little plastic and aluminum thing. They want their Woodstock hunting rifles, their 30-06s, etc. They think the round is too small. It goes nowhere. And the symbolism it has at that time is as a failure, because as we describe in the book, the gun failed massively on the fields of Vietnam. I mean, the military made a bunch of changes to Stoner's design, really ill-informed decisions, and these guns were jamming, Marines were dying with the gun in their hands, and that's the image that people had of the gun in the 60s and 70s. It has this terrible taste in the mouth of the American public. We don't want this gun. But when does that start to change? I mean, that starts to change in the 90s when there's this big gun control push, and we can talk about that more in depth. Suddenly, this gun becomes a symbol of the Second Amendment, and that's really when the symbolism starts to take off, and it only grows over the next three decades.
I was fascinated by the section of the book that was about this early history of the civilian marketing of the AR-15. One of the details that really stuck out to me was that before it called it the Sporter, they were going to call it the Comanche, which there's so much to say about that. But the other part that fascinated me was the fact that political radicals in your telling really are kind of some of the early adopters of this weapons platform. I wonder if there was anything else to share about that part of the story of the AR-15 that you found in your research.
Well, I mean, this gun was considered a military weapon. It was designed for the military. And so as radical groups on the right or the left began to talk about battling society or elements of society, they gravitated toward this gun. So certainly there were right-wing groups that embraced the rifle, as we write about, and then also the Black Panthers, the American Indian Movement. People were drawn to this gun as a, and then later groups, cult groups like the group at Waco, you know, but people were drawn to this gun as a way to battle society. That, of course, gets far deeper and far more complex as we go on in American history. But certainly from the very beginning, as Zusha pointed out, the gun was not popular with the average hunter at the time. But some of these groups were drawn to this rifle.
There was a funny kind of anecdote that we came across. Well, Cam was doing all this research on these crazy radical groups. It came across this, one of the first police cases involving an AR-15 was this group called the Minutemen, anti-communist, far-right group. And so there was this guy, Robert Rain Romero, who was arrested as part of an investigation, and they found an AR on him, Colt Sporter. We tracked him down. We're like, we wanted to talk to this first guy who was arrested having this AR-15. And he, you know, of course he denied all the charges, said he wasn't part of the group, et cetera, et cetera. So we have to put that on the record. When we asked about the gun, he was like, I didn't really like it that much. He's like, he'd rather have like a 22 caliber rifle, you know, which is a very small rifle for your listeners, low power. And his quote was, I didn't really get into it. So yes, these groups were really drawn to this gun, and certainly it was used occasionally, but I thought it was funny that one of the first radicals to buy this thing really didn't like it.
That is funny. And yeah, so it sounds like those claims he made were a little less than credible in your eyes about his involvement with the Minutemen. A couple of things you said there got me thinking too about some of the funny ways in which the AR-15 is still so frequently misrepresented, I think both by its critics and its champions in political discourse. Like, I still hear batted around this claim like, oh, this wasn't designed as a weapon of war. It was called the Sporter. That's always what it was for, et cetera, et cetera. I feel like the book pretty definitively gives the lie to that defense of AR-15. But on the left, I still hear all the time things like, oh, you know, this is a uniquely powerful rifle that has no place on the civilian market. Well, I've got bad news about most deer rifles out there, right? If you think a 223 round is extremely powerful. So, I mean, from your perspective, after having done all this research, what are the misrepresentations that frustrate you the most in political conversations about the AR-15?
Yeah, let me take the military origin story first. A big part of this book is to bust all these myths. People have all these bumper sticker slogans in their heads about this gun. It's high powered, it's a military weapon, it's not an assault rifle, it is an assault rifle. And so we wanted to get to the bottom of every one of these questions. So I'll just take the military origin story, which cuts both ways. So on the one hand, right, you have gun control activists. They say, oh, it's a weapon of war, weapon of war, weapon of war. On the other side, the gun rights people say, no, it's not, no, it's not. So on one point, the gun rights people are correct in this sense, which is that since time immemorial, gun companies have made weapons for the military and then sold them to civilians. This is not a new thing. So for gun control activists to claim this related only to the AR-15, that's not right. It's been going on since the revolver, as we point out in the book. I mean, Sam Colt came up with the revolver. He sold it to the military, and then he sold it to civilians using that very, like, you know, the cachet of its military use. So that's been going on forever. On the other hand, gun rights activists who say this is not a military weapon in any way are completely wrong. Stoner designed this gun at the request of the U.S. military to their specifications. That is how he came up with the type of gun, with the ammunition, with the 223 round. This is, you know, for your listeners, this round is really interesting. It's small. It's tiny. It's really tiny. Stoner designed it so it goes really fast. And so that's how you have more injury potential, by shooting this tiny round really fast. And then when it hits the body, it goes unstable really quickly. And so it kind of spins around like a top and creates outsized damage. That does not mean that it creates more damage than like a deer hunting rifle, especially depending on the type of ammo, right? Say you have ammo that, you know, the hollow points, which mushrooms out, that's going to create a huge wound. But what they found in comparing to other types of military ammo was that this tiny bullet would spin around like a top and create a lot of damage, whereas when they were shooting larger bullets, it would just go straight through a human body. And that was the contrast that Stoner was using to sell this gun to the military. So certainly he built this gun to the military specifications, and then Colt took that same design, made it semi-automatic, and sold it on the civilian market. There are a couple changes that we don't need to get into because we don't want your listeners to go to sleep, but the main difference is that it's semi-automatic. So certainly it was built for the military. The myth-busting in this was so fun and interesting. So let's take assault rifle too, and then I'll leave you in peace. Liberals, gun control activists love to say, ban those assault rifles. And then gun rights activists say, these aren't assault rifles. That's not what these are called. Here's how the story goes. Way back in the day, when we were all fighting World War II, Hitler and his army came up with a gun called the Sturmgewehr. Not sure about the pronunciation. I don't know German too well. And that was translated by U.S. intelligence as assault rifle or storm rifle. And this term came to be known in military circles to describe a mid-range rifle that could shoot automatic or semi-automatic. So select fire, mid-range military rifle. That's what assault rifle meant to the military. However, when gun companies in the 80s started selling semi-automatic versions of these guns to civilians, they called them assault rifles to try to sell them, to give them that tough military cachet. They were trying to cash in on their military origins. It was literally the gun companies, the gun industry, that popularized this term for the use for civilian weapons. But what happened is that gun control activists, they saw the use of this term and they were like, oh man, we're going to use that to our advantage. And they started saying, you got to ban these assault rifles. And it was a much more powerful rhetorical tool. The term assault had this real like negative connotation. And so it really stuck. And that was one place where the gun control side won the rhetorical debate. I think in most other cases,
they lost
gun rights
it, yeah.
activists have been successful in dominating the debate in America. They won the battle over the term assault. So yes, it is not an assault rifle, but also yes, it was popularized by the gun industry itself.
I would add to that, your point is well taken regarding people who are not familiar with guns, who advocate gun control, will say, look, you know, this gun is very powerful, the dynamics of the rounds, but the truth is this gun is super easy to shoot. It's really easy to shoot. What it was designed for, it was designed so that U.S. soldiers or our allies could go into the field with a lot of ammunition because the gun was very light and fire a lot of rounds really quickly in mid-range in a combat situation at relatively, you know, mid-range battle and have more bullets. But that's those same design functions, which, again, were excellent for their purpose, make it easy for, you know, a 10-year-old kid to pick up the gun and be able to shoot it. I mean, anybody can shoot this gun.
Thinking about that, right, and also this interesting, and I really appreciated that like kind of backstory on the evolution of the term assault rifle and the imperfect ways it actually maps on to the technological features of a semi-automatic rifle. I think one of the themes that emerges in the story of the gun control movement that you tell, both 1994 at the federal level and the various state level efforts to regulate these weapons, you know, we've often devolved into these kind of feature bans that the gun industry is able to kind of work around very quickly. There are some infamous examples of weapons for mass shootings that have been precisely those workarounds, right? My question, I guess, is as I was reading, I was wondering, the gun rights advocates always say, oh, that's because, you know, this legislation is written by people who don't understand firearms. They don't understand the technical aspects of this. You know, they end up with these ineffectual bans. They're just a pain for gun owners. Is that really it? Or is it that the gun industry has their fingers on this legislation, these various pieces of legislation, I should say, so early on that they're able to kind of render them ineffectual from the jump?
We wondered about that too. So for instance, there's this question about why was the assault weapons ban only 10 years, right? I think liberals, they always regret that. They say, we wish it had just been made permanent. We were sure when we went into this research that this was just because the gun industry went in and lobbied and asked for, you know, a limited time frame. But what we found is that the senators themselves, three Democratic senators, debated amongst themselves about what kind of time frame this thing should have and landed on 10 years before they even started negotiating with Republicans or gun industry advocates. And this really surprised some of the leading gun control advocates at the time. They said, why did you give this away before you even started negotiating? So certainly they were doing that because they were afraid of the power of the gun lobby, right? And they were afraid that if they tried to pass a permanent ban, it wouldn't make it through the Senate or Congress because there's a lot of Republicans and also Democrats who were very pro-gun at the time. But certainly the gun industry did not write that into the bill. Like, they weren't the ones who asked for that. It was a preemptive move by Democratic senators. And that was actually the case in a lot of writing of this legislation. It wasn't written by the gun industry. There are other cases where the gun industry literally wrote laws, like the law that made it really impossible to sue the gun industry. That was written by gun industry lobbyists, we found. But certainly the assault weapons bans were written by Democrats and by people who did not know a lot about guns. They were written in a way because the Democrats feared that they would have a hard time getting them through.
I mean, this almost came, the 1994 assault weapons ban, so-called, really came as almost a shock to the gun industry, who thought, okay, well, we're done. But then really quickly, they started looking at the letter of the law and figuring out ways to modify their rifles and get back in business. And they did very quickly. That ended up being a gift to the gun industry in numerous ways, one of which is They just continued selling their modified versions of AR-15s and other guns right away, very shortly after, and gun sales continued throughout the supposed ban. And then you've also told Americans you can't have something, which is not something that ever goes over well with the American public. And gun owners were itching for when the ban was lifted 10 years later, sales went through the roof.
Just to add one more point to what Cam's saying is that I think your question brings up an important point, which is that at the time, the gun industry actually didn't care about these guns. They were not lobbying heavily on this bill because the gun was made by a handful of companies, Colt and a couple of like real renegade straggling little mom and pop shops. But the men running the gun industry, the Bill Rugers of the world, they didn't give a shit about these guns. In fact, they didn't make them. They didn't want them. I mean, you had Ruger, this titan of the gun industry back then, and he was really the leader in the face of it, writing a letter to Congress during the Bush presidency saying they should ban high-capacity magazines, right? Could you imagine a gun company CEO saying that today? No. But that's because these guns were such a small percentage of the market back then. You know, before the ban went into effect in 94, there were about 400,000 ARs in the country. And, you know, there were other guns that were banned, but they were even less. AKs, whatever, MAC-10s, even less than that. So less than a million of these guns in the country, probably. Since that time, it's exploded. Now there's more than 20, 25 million ARs in the country. So at the time, this was kind of an afterthought, right, for the gun industry, for everyone. No one thought it was a big deal getting rid of them.
Obviously, we're at a place now where the level of investment of the gun industry is extraordinary. I love the narration of what it's like to go to the SHOT Show now and the prominence of the AR-15 at that exhibition. Are we at a point where the political feasibility of any form of gun control that would impact these weapons would be just totally politically unfeasible? I mean, is there anything short of magazine capacity bans or banning semi-automatic rifles that could really limit the kind of damage we're seeing done at some of these mass shootings where AR-15s are used?
Well, we spend a lot of time toward the end of the book wrestling with those issues. I think you just said politically unfeasible. I think practically unfeasible. I mean, how in the world could you round up? I mean, if you stopped the sale of AR-15 rifles tomorrow, you still have 20 to 25 million of them in circulation in civilian hands. So how in the world would a ban work? Are you going to go house to house? No, that's never going to happen. So the notion of a ban really has become an impossibility at this point. That being said, there's all kinds of things, and we discuss them in the book, that can and are being applied to try to make our world a safer place. That is, I think, something that everyone needs to start focusing on, and many people are. And some of these ideas can be perceived as liberal. Some of them can be perceived as conservative. People creating better security at schools. If that stops a shooter, great. If you can limit magazine capacity, that's a very complicated problem. But if you could do that, that has shown to have some impact in terms of when someone starts a mass shooting, they have to change out the magazine. That gives people time to either tackle the person or get away. There are things, red flag laws, that I'm sure you guys have talked about a lot on the podcast. But I mean, those kinds of laws are starting to have an impact in terms of getting this kind of gun away from people who shouldn't have it. The vast majority of people who own an AR-15 aren't out to hurt anybody. I had a guy, strong advocate of the AR-15, tell me, if we were all psychos, you'd all be dead. He was trying to be comforting. It wasn't very comforting. Their notion is, like, most of us are law-abiding citizens who happen to like guns or bought it for political reasons or bought it because we like to shoot at target practice or whatever. But the problem is, in that large circle of people, there's a very small circle of people who go to war with society. And they can do that really quickly with this gun and the way it was designed.
Yeah, I think when you talk about solutions to this problem and what can be done, you need to look to the younger generation that is very different from you and I. They grew up with the threat, constant threat of school shootings, right? So they're acutely aware of that. At the same time, they grew up with Call of Duty and the ever-present image of the AR-15. So in some ways, they're more accepting of AR-15s than the older generation of hunters. But at the same time, they're more in favor of laws that would keep ARs out of the hands of people who might shoot up schools. And so you see more support from younger people for laws like red flag laws or other laws that, you know, look at people's mental health and whether they should have guns. So specifically targeting people who shouldn't have ARs instead of a blanket ban. So I think you're going to see two things, right? You're going to see more gun owners as we go forward. And at the same time, you're going to see more laws focused on keeping guns out of the hands of people who shouldn't have them.
So, you know, I teach gun culture seminars here in close touch with Gen Z in that way, right? And I'd say 75% of the students who come into my classes come in because they've been kind of politically mobilized by the anxiety or even terror they felt from those lockdown drills in high school and earlier. And there's also students who come in as AR enthusiasts and all that. But the perception that they have as 18 to 20 year olds coming into my classes of US gun culture really is focused on these spectacular, they're not even mass shootings, right? They're a particular kind of mass shootings that occurs in a public place, usually with a stranger killing strangers, which is not at all paradigmatic of what mass shootings in the US are all about, you know, which tend to happen in closer kinship networks and even within families, right? That's the gun culture they know. In so many ways, the work I do in those classes is kind of trying to introduce them to the reality of our gun violence epidemic as it actually unfolds, right? And you have this fascinating moment in your prologue where you kind of acknowledge this problem, right? The fact that so many homicides and suicides, the vast majority, are carried out with handguns, not rifles, and that when you look at the, you know, the big picture of US gun violence, AR-15s actually account for a very, very small fraction of that. Like looking at the FBI's 2023 statistics, 31,908 homicides identified as having been carried out with a handgun, 2,090 carried out with a rifle, right? So, you know, you acknowledge this, say that the story of handgun violence is an important story. It's not the story we're going to tell here. We're going to focus on what you call the lightning rod of the American gun debate. As you were writing the book, though, were there ever anxieties that you're kind of adding to this sense that we're paying a whole lot of attention to this one weapon platform, this one kind of gun violence, and not this other bigger problem?
In my day job, I cover guns in America, so I've written about all types of gun violence. I think that the type we are writing about in the book is particularly difficult and intractable and scary in a different type of way. So everyday gun violence, you know, there's domestic violence, there's, you know, gang shootings, that sort of stuff. The difference with those is that those don't scare the public. You know, they don't scare you. They don't make you feel like, oh, I don't want to go to the movie theater. I don't want to go to the supermarket. I don't want to go to school. Although, so these, yeah, there's mass shootings are a very small percentage of homicides in America, but they scare the shit out of us. They are actually the definition of, you know, they're terrorism, right?
But who's the us there?
Americans, I would say.
No, I mean, look, I think your point is there are neighborhoods in this country where gunfire is a regular terrorism that takes place. And they don't involve AR-15s, they involve handguns or other types of weapons, and that's true. But we watched this gun become a favorite of mass shooters, and we watched it become this political icon that everyone wanted to fight over, this political chew toy that if you drive around your town, you're going to see somebody with a bumper sticker that has an AR-15 on it, silhouette of an AR-15. And you know immediately that person is a Second Amendment advocate. If you go to a gun control rally, you're going to see people with a silhouette of an AR-15 and a line through it. And you know exactly what that means. You know, on January 6th, when they were outside of Congress getting excited, they were waving flags with silhouettes of the AR-15 saying, come and take it. This gun, for better or for worse, has become the center of this debate. And as Zusha pointed out, the problems that it presents are pretty difficult to try to resolve and terrorize everybody. And if you live in a neighborhood where there's gun violence, that's traumatic and terrible constantly, right? It is a weapon that has terrorized this country. But at the same time, it's incredibly popular and prevalent. So we have to come to terms with how are we going to make our world safer. But these guns are here.
So in terms of the production of that terror, and it is, yeah, it's palpable, right? And it's a national thing. My wife's a reporter. I talk to reporters about these issues a lot, and I'd be curious to hear your response to this. I mean, do you feel being in a newsroom or just thinking about what you're assigned, do you feel some frustration sometimes about what kinds of gun violence incidents get covered or you're asked to cover even and what kinds don't, right? Like going back to those neighborhoods where you might easily have a dozen or more deaths on a weekend versus an event that takes place in a different kind of probably wider, probably more affluent neighborhood that kills six or seven people in one go. And the latter event is the focus of our conversation.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question, right? We write for a national paper, and so we try to write things about national interest. I've covered a lot of stories, you know, about gun violence in neighborhoods and solutions. I think one of the really important things in teasing out different types of gun violence is that there's different types of solutions, right? And that's also one of the key things we wanted to try to do with our book. If you're talking about domestic violence, there's some pretty tried and true ways to prevent domestic killings, right? You have restraining orders, red flag laws, all that sort of stuff. And with gang violence, there's also different set of solutions. In gangs, for instance, a lot of folks have criminal records. You know, there's different ways of trying to stop gun trafficking, try to squash gang beefs, all that sort of thing. But with mass shootings, in particular with AR-15, it's a very unique problem, which is that most of the attackers don't have criminal records, right? Most of them don't have a history of real, you know, criminal violence or anything like that. Most of them walk into a store and buy a gun legally or buy it online and have it delivered to a store. So that requires us to think about it in a very different way. And I think it's really important to treat each type of gun violence as its own thing so you can understand what to do. And that's a really big problem where we have all of the issues with gun violence being conflated and being proposed with one solution and that never works, right? So what we really need to do is tease it out. And that's what we tried to do with the book. We're very clear, like this is a very particular problem and it requires a very particular solution. And I would say, interestingly enough, you know, just to push back on giving the news media too much blame in this, well, first, let me take a look.
Well, I think it's the news reading public too, right? I mean, those are the stories that get the clicks as well, right?
Right. Let's take a little blame and say that I think at first, us in the news media, when mass shootings first became a real thing after 2010 and just started snowballing, I think there was too much written about the shooters, right? I would say there was a lot of profiles, a lot of like very salacious, voyeuristic stuff going on where they're looking at who these shooters were. But I think that we've changed a lot since then. We've realized that the attention these shooters get only motivates them to, you know, other shooters to go out and commit the same things. And I think a lot of news outlets have really dialed back their coverage of the shooters, don't name them, all this sort of stuff. So I think the news industry has learned a lot from our early coverage of those events. But at the same time, like you said, a story about a local solution to gun violence is not going to be really interesting to a lot of people for whatever reason. A story about a mass shooting people are reading like wildfire. And it's sort of the same effect, you know, when people drive by an accident on the freeway, everyone stops to look at it. I mean, it's just natural. It's human nature. But that doesn't mean we stop writing those important stories about local solutions to gun violence. I mean, I've done some very interesting stories about these mentoring programs for the most likely shooters in a violent city. There's these programs, right, where they go and they try to find, it's like the hitmen for the gangs, and then they try to mentor them and give them money, actually, to stop shooting people. They actually have worked so far. It's really fascinating. So there are ways to approach those and write those and cover those. But like I said, sometimes those aren't as interesting to the reading public.
I would also say that our frustration with covering mass shootings, I mean, how could you not cover an event like Sandy Hook? Of course. But I think Zusha and I both felt a frustration in covering a horrible, horrible event like that and seeing a community ripped to shreds and then, you know, bumper stickers about, you know, hashtag whatever the city was strong and people having a candlelight vigil, and then you're gone. Then you're going to cover the next thing. And we felt that this book is our answer to that. We wanted to dive in and understand this particular rifle, this particular, with its fascinating history going back to the Cold War, to how it became what it has become, and tell that story as a way to discuss how inventions take on a life of their own, how, as they move through society, how the gun debate has been shaped and distorted by both sides in the debate, and how we got here. And I think there have been, and there will continue to be, great books about handgun violence in this country and the epidemic of violence in certain neighborhoods in this country. And there should be. We wrote a book about the AR-15.
Right on. Yeah. And that interview with Sullivan at the end is so striking. I had no idea he was still around to be interviewed. And I think it's remarkable when you're able to talk to people on that level, and you were so often in the book, how less polarized this whole conversation seemed than it might from the outside. And maybe building on that, I wondered if we could close with a couple questions. And first is just, I would love to hear, I know you've been covering these to a certain extent, your take on the AR-15 in the news, but also kind of guns in the latest political cycle more generally. I was really struck by Harris's moment with Oprah, where she talked about her Glock in that kind of laughing tone, but also kind of maintained the focus on an assault weapons ban, but backed off the buyback campaign promise she'd made earlier in her career. I'd just be fascinated to hear what you thought of all that during the campaign and where you think we are now with the incoming Trump administration.
Cam and I actually wrote a story, you know, around that time about how there's this large increase in liberal gun owners, which is very interesting, right? So Kamala coming out talking about how she has a gun, and trust me, I'm not going to break into her house now. You know, it actually really touched on something that's going on in society, which is that gun ownership is really growing. I think what we're going to see during the Trump administration is zero gun regulations, which means that gun sales will probably go down, right? Whenever there's no gun regulations, people don't want to buy guns. During his first administration, there was this thing called the Trump slump, which, you know, in the industry, sales went through the floor. A lot of companies went bankrupt. The fear of gun regulations is something that motivates Americans to buy a lot of guns. But interestingly, now you see more liberals buying guns. I think we're going to see that trend actually continue during the Trump administration. You know, it's not the same volume as you see from conservatives, but it's still noticeable. We looked at sort of the various polls from NORC, from Gallup, and you do see liberal gun ownership edging up since the pandemic.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this incoming administration, you're not going to see any substantial gun legislation. I am interested, and Zusha and I are both watching the courts very carefully. There have been some interesting decisions there, interesting cases coming forward there. There could be movement in that area. I'm interested to see the sales numbers, who's buying what and where.
Are there any particular cases, kind of like post-Rahimi, that you really have your eye on as that you think might be transformative in the courts?
I think just because of the book we wrote, there's a lot that are really interesting and probably more imminent, but I think we're all watching to see what happens with state assault weapons bans. There's a number of challenges, you know, to California's assault weapons ban, to Illinois', that are sort of winding their way up to the Supreme Court. We're not sure if they'll take it up, but I think that would be the most interesting thing. In the past, I think even in the Heller decision, right, the Supreme Court basically said there's certain types of guns that you can regulate. You know, that's what Scalia was saying. It'll be interesting to see what happens with this Supreme Court.
Here on Guns Unpacked, we like to finish where we interview people who have written brilliant books about guns by asking you, what are you reading now that might be of interest to those interested in gun culture or other things?
I would say that C.J. Chivers' book, The Gun, which is about the Kalashnikov, was really sort of a guiding book for us as we dove into writing American Gun about the AR-15. He does discuss the AR-15 a little bit, but he doesn't really discuss American landscape regarding guns. He really focuses on the Kalashnikov, how it was developed and how it spread around the world. And it's really a fascinating read. And I would recommend everybody read that. I also, a lot of our book was about problems with the gun in the Vietnam War. And I read Tim O'Brien's The Things They Carried, which is a fiction short stories about soldiers, American soldiers of Vietnam, which is a great, great book. But mostly, to be honest, I'm reading modernist poetry at night just to chill out from all the grim stuff that I cover. And I've been rereading Louis McNeice's Autumn Journal.
Great question about books. I mean, we're authors. We love books. We read all types of books. But the one I happen to be making my way through right now is the LBJ series by Robert Caro, which is, you know, one of the most brilliant works of history that I've ever encountered. And I would encourage all your listeners to take a read.
Thanks so much for joining us for this fascinating conversation about the history of America's most controversial gun. I'm Alex Trimble Young, and this is Guns Unpacked, the podcast of ASU's Center for the Study of Guns in Society.